Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. We're so glad that you're joining us today from wherever you are. Whether you attend one of our Denver locations or listen online, our hope is to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. And if you'd like to financially support our community and beyond as we set aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, my friends. I stand before you not even sure where to start. Here we are just a few days out from the events that unfolded in our nation's capital on Wednesday, when we witnessed images of people storming and breaching the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Like many of you, I was somewhere between transfixed and paralyzed, unable to process what I was seeing. And I imagine for many of you, tensions and emotions ran high on Wednesday. I know that was true for me. My chest filled and churned with competing emotions, sadness and frustration, confusion, disbelief, anger. All of those emotions were present. On Wednesday evening, I even had to reach out to a good friend after a text exchange to seek forgiveness because I had responded in an unkind and an unloving way. Maybe you can relate. Maybe like me, rather than listen to your emotions, rather than observe them without judgment, you reacted and allowed them to have rule over you, what you said or what you did. Now, all of these feelings and tensions and emotions, they swirled within me as I was working on the next few sermons for the season of teaching we are currently in, which is a season of teaching about hope, which sounds comical. I mean, doesn't it? Hope? Really? Right now? And while I had a sermon prepared for today, I had a sense we should scrap the sermon for this week because I felt all of us have been thinking and talking about what transpired on Wednesday. So I reached out to some in leadership here seeking their wisdom, and they affirmed what was in my gut. Now, I don't presume this will be the perfect explanation, nor will it be the final answer or definitive response. Perhaps this will only offer some direction in the midst of our collective confusion. So today, I want to share some thoughts about what unfolded on Wednesday, a day that will long live in the memory of people around the world. Now, some of you may already be thinking, oh, great, here we go, getting political. So allow me to say this. Here at DCC, we believe the one place where we should be able to talk about anything and everything is precisely in the moments when the church is gathered together. No topic should be off limits. And yes, that includes politics. And by politics, I don't mean partisan ideology, which is increasingly toxic. What I do mean when I use the word political is public affairs of a particular culture or nation or country. And so today we will talk about the public affairs of our nation. But we will not stop there because we will also speak about hope because we need to speak about hope. And I say that because we are a fractured nation. We are a broken country. We are a collection of wounded souls and broken hearts and hurting lives and fearful individuals. While we are a nation that has long claimed to be Christian, all the while we've been perpetuating injustice, celebrating violence, extolling greed, and encouraging consumerism. What we saw on Wednesday is but a manifestation of a disease that has long simmered in the bowels of the United States of America. Yes, we should be outraged. Yes, we should be angry. Yes, we should be in disbelief. But let me be clear. While it is right to feel that way about an angry mob breaching the Capitol building, we would be remiss if we were not also outraged and angered and in disbelief regarding our lack of awareness and how long it has taken the majority of our nation's citizens to wake up to our national sin and collective guilt. And the beginning of any healing, the start of any renewal comes by acknowledging what is true, by stating what is true. Within the Christian tradition, we call that confession. We need to confess our sins, stating what we have done and what we have left undone. We need to confess how we as individuals have participated in the systemic sins of this nation and how we've been complicit in furthering the ideas of this empire. We must remember the words of Jesus who, according to the Gospel of John, said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." And what happened Wednesday brought things to the surface and into our offices and into our living rooms, and we watched them on our digital devices. It brought things into the light, and we as a nation, we saw something. And the question is, will we acknowledge it? Will we have the eyes to see? Because if we don't or we won't, well, then our guilt remains. And what we saw, it's nothing new. I mean, this is what happens when anger festers. And while Wednesday may have been shocking for us, if we give it a moment's thought, what we witnessed was simply the next logical step for many, because you can't go around using inflammatory rhetoric that stokes the flames of anger and expect those words not to move listeners toward physical action and violence. Communication theorists have long observed that as language escalates and words become increasingly toxic and violent, its eventual end is physical violence. This is what we witnessed with the insurrection on Wednesday. And what we've really watched unfold for some time, words soaked in anger and vitriol being slung around with reckless abandon. And this has been routine and normalized over the last several years by the way we speak of one another, and especially the way we speak of those with whom we disagree. And we see this in many places. Of course, this is nonstop online in the various channels where we post our thoughts and opinions. We've stopped listening. We only want to be heard. And we seek out approval from those with whom we have already found favor. In turn, we slander and we accuse and we tear down anyone who dare disagree with our opinions, partisan or otherwise. We call our brothers and our sisters fools with impunity, conveniently forgetting the warning of Jesus who said, "Anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,' is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." Jesus' insistence was that words that destroy or degrade any person made in the image and likeness of God is equal to murder. Now, we see the same thing in the media, and over the last several years, we witnessed this from the person who occupies the highest office in our country. Now, let me pause right here and address a few things. First thought, I do not pretend that our current president is the only one who has fueled the hate and division in our country. Many people who've been entrusted to lead and serve in our country have done this. Now, of course, the words of our president on Wednesday and leading up to that moment were and are egregious. However, his awful example is but one of several awful examples these days. It seems that respect and dignity and honoring one another has gone the way of the dinosaur. Second thought, it's possible at this point you may have an argument in your head ready to defend or excuse your side or your preferred party or your politicians. Or you may want to point out that our president's rhetoric that led to the insurrection on Wednesday is far worse than anything that's been said by others. Which leads me to ask a question. Is it possible for us to observe wrongdoing and even name the wrongdoing for what it is, while at the same time not believing that we or those we support are without thought? Are we able to be those who practice self-reflection and even in moments of great passion do not drift toward those who throw stones because we believe we are without sin? I will speak for myself and say this. I am at my absolute worst when I believe I am entirely innocent and the other is entirely guilty. Because in those moments, my heart reeks of arrogance. I'm a whitewashed tomb. I look good from the outside, but inside I'm full of death. Because if we believe we are not capable of doing the same things that we witnessed Wednesday, the things that we're quick to condemn, we are far closer than we think to being able to do the exact same thing. Third thought. Why is it we can't have conversations about politics without automatically doing so along partisan lines? Now, let me be clear. with specific regard to what happened on Wednesday, there are many people clearly at fault in that specific instance. What they said was dangerous and must be condemned. But in all of this, what I find interesting is how difficult it has become to name those actions and words as wrong without others assuming you're sold out for the other side. If you must know, my voter registration is unaffiliated. And in the last 20 years, I have voted both for Republicans and Democrats. And at this point, I may have just lost some of you and confused others. And I say that because I want us just to stop for a moment, take a deep breath, and ask ourselves a few questions. Is it possible for us to transcend binary thinking? Has our either-or thinking ever proven to be helpful? Is it possible for us to stop making everything so partisan? Have we lost our prophetic imagination as the people of God? Is it possible that our hearts and our minds have been co-opted by the media and politicians to the point that we've come to believe that everything, even the most complex problems in our world, fall very neatly into one of two categories? Are we willing to recognize speaking out against any sitting president or any other political leader does not automatically make me or anyone else who speaks out a member of the other party? Are we willing to admit that to call out the poor behavior and actions of this president or any other political leader is not necessarily motivated by partisan politics? Because there are times when it is necessary to speak up and to speak out. And especially in the moments when the people of God, rather than be set apart, rather than be those whose speech and actions reveal the love of God and the love of the other, we need to speak up when we contribute to the hate and division and the separateness that is slowly poisoning all of us. We need to speak out when we've given our allegiance over to the empire and its ways. The ways that tell us that success is always about moving in an upward direction and that we must be victorious, and victory can only come at the defeat of the other. I've said it before and I will say it again. The cross is not a flagpole for the stars and stripes. We are called to give our allegiance first and foremost to the kingdom of heaven and not to the United States of America, and we are not called to hold dual allegiance. And if you are familiar with my body of teaching, you are well aware I believe it is wrong for those who identify as Christians to pin our hopes first and foremost on any political leader or party. And quite frankly, far too many Christians are doing this today on all sides. We have been seduced by the vision of empire and allowed ourselves to believe, in the words of John Howard Yoder, that the forces which really determine the march of history are in the hands of leaders of the armies and the markets, in such measure that if Christians are to contribute to the renewal of society, they will need to seek, like everyone else, in fact, in competition with everyone else, to become in their turn lords of the state and the economy, so as to use that power toward the ends they consider desirable. In so many ways, we've lowered ourselves to be those who believe this and simply repeat the talking points and platforms of a particular candidate. And this is as true today as ever. What happened to a desire, to a response to the invitation from the prophet to be those who act justly and love mercy and walk humbly with our God? I mean, let's be honest, it's easy to critique our president. And there have been many times when we should. But I wonder, is it possible that there's something deeper going on within us, within our country? I mean, it's just too easy to blame it all on him. I mean, it feels good because doing so allows us not to have to deal with our own shadow. And by shadow, I mean that which is true about us, but what we will deny until our dying day. Maybe the reason he demands so much attention is because in some ways he holds a mirror up to all of us, whether we support him or are against him. And if this is true, then how can we respond in a way that will move us forward individually and collectively? Now, I've spent time with this question over the last 4+ years, quite honestly, and I've had to wade through my anger and my disillusionment. I've had to wade through my many moments of self-righteousness and holier-than-thou-ness. And the best response I could come up with is this: grieve. I need to grieve. Now, I'm not saying this from a place of moral superiority or a place of condescension or from believing I have it all right and those people have it all wrong. It comes from a place of genuine sadness and heartache rooted in the reality that our president and an amplified partisan politics has incited and furthered division within the kingdom of God, within the church, and all of us have gone along with it. Now, if you've been around DCC for a while, you've probably heard me or others talk about unity over uniformity. But in this context, I mean, how do we even get there? I mean, it feels impossible, doesn't it? Maybe it's because we focused on the word unity so much. And in doing so, we've come to believe that unity is putting on smiles and pretending that all the hard things don't exist and we're all friends and family and things are just peachy. My friends, that's denial. That's not unity. Maybe we need to focus on the latter word, uniformity. We are not asking for uniformity. And people who want uniformity, you know, for everyone to think and act and believe the same, well, those people are interested in cults, not in church. Keep in mind, the vision of St. John was people of every tribe and every tongue and every nation together. It was not uniform. I mean, even Jesus' disciples came from different political persuasions. Matthew was a Roman sympathizer who exploited his own people in Israel for his monetary gain. And Simon was an extremist guerrilla fighter who was a part of a movement that would be happy to slit the throats of people like Matthew. This movement of Jesus has never, even from its beginnings, demanded uniformity. If anything, I'd argue it invites us to be generous and to be open and open up space that will lead us to be uncomfortable. So what do we do now? Is there any way forward from here? Is unity a foolish pursuit? Is it impossible? Should we just find those with whom we agree and move forward together without them, whoever they might be? I mean, that would be easy, wouldn't it? And it would feel better too. You know, the belief that if we just get rid of the other, then the world would somehow be a better place. That view, by the way, is central to all fundamental religion. And I point this out because this sort of fundamentalism is what I have seen creep into the minds and the hearts of people on all sides, whether conservative or progressive. And if we're honest, we should all call ourselves regressive. We have become the very thing we criticize. We have acted in deplorable ways against the actions we find deplorable. We've spoken out with hatred against words we find to be hateful. We've become monsters in our attempts to defeat what we believe to be monsters. And perhaps the most common sin of humanity, it's been a part of the human story from the beginning, and it's not working. And it never has. And should we continue to believe that progress and healing will come through our continued poor behavior and reprehensible speech, we will only see things devolve into more tragic circumstances than those in which we currently find ourselves. And I must say, I've seen the same level of hate in word and action from many who are opposed to President Trump as I have from those who support him, in the belief that if we can get the other party into power, then things will be better. May I remind you that the other party coming into power has often happened and we're still here? Einstein is credited with saying, "No problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it." I hear that and I think, we've lost the plot. Perhaps we've forgotten who we are. Maybe our imaginations have dried up. So what if just for a little while we stop looking outward at all that is swirling in our world? What if we stopped drinking from the cauldron of social media and stopped immersing ourselves in the nonstop news cycle? What would happen if we took a moment to look inward, to explore our hearts, to consider how we feel, to examine our allegiances, our emotions. What could happen if we chose to do that? Is it possible that we would be invited to a place of deeper healing? Like maybe we would move toward wholeness. Carl Jung spoke of how the word whole and the word holy are both derived from the word heal, so that the condition of wholeness and holiness are synonymous. It reminds me of Peter in his first letter to the church, where he says that we, the people of God, are called to be holy, to become whole. Perhaps if we were whole, we would have a vision and could consider new possibilities that transcend our binary either-or partisan categories. Maybe we could explore our longings, our true, deep, God-inspired desires for ourselves and our country and our world. I'm not talking about some paradisal dream, as Wendell Berry says. I'm talking about a willingness to endure hardship and suffering that we might actually see the kingdom of heaven take root right here, right now, on this earth. So let me ask again, what do you really want? Maybe one way we can think about this is to return to how we felt and the emotions we experienced on Wednesday. Now, I could quickly say, oh, I was angry, and I was. But what I have learned and what I am learning about myself is that if I can pay attention long enough, my anger always points toward fear or wounding or sorrow that resides deeper within me. So when I ask you, when you saw the images and watched the videos, how did you feel? What stirred in your gut and why? I'm asking, what caused those emotions to well up within? Think of it this way. Imagine you applied for a job, and not just any job, like your dream job. You sent in your resume, you secured an interview, and it went well and led to a second interview, and that went even better than the first, and you made it into the final round of interviews. And you went to that final interview and you left knowing you did really well. You did so well, you were confident you got the job you've long wanted. But then 2 days later, you received a call from someone in the company you'd never met, briefly informing you that you did not get the job and that they went with another candidate. How do you feel? Disappointed? Crushed? Well, of course you feel this way, because you had a vision and a dream and a hope of what could be. But then in the course of a quick phone call, that was all taken away. You experienced loss. And so I ask, what loss did you experience on Wednesday? What vision or dream or hope was taken away when an angry mob stormed the Capitol? Now, of course, it was hard to watch and shocking and tragic, but beneath your feelings, did sorrow and grief show up? And if they did, will you grieve? And should you choose to grieve, what could that open up within you? Because grieving our loss has the power to bring with it new life. Rachel Naomi Remen wrote that every great loss demands that we choose life again. We need to grieve in order to do this. The pain we have not grieved over will always stand between us and life. Grieving allows us to heal, to remember with love rather than pain. It is a sorting process. One by one, you let go of the things that are gone and you mourn for them. One by one, you take hold of the things that have become a part of who you are and you build again. Because it's precisely in the pain that we can find life. The French priest Teilhard de Chardin wrote of how he came to some of his greatest insights by witnessing the pain and horror and atrocities and death while he was in the trenches of World War I. Now, he was not a soldier, he was a stretcher bearer, which meant he carried his fellow countrymen who were wounded and dying through the trenches to safety. And day after day, seeing carnage up close, the result of violence that comes with war, in the midst of this, he realized that the horrors and destruction of war were a sign of something breaking through into the world, something not yet realized coming to birth. In the 1960s, Edward Lorenz observed that systems break down because something new is being formed. Evolutionary biology teaches us the same thing. In any ecosystem, as long as things are in stasis, nothing new evolves or grows. It is only when an ecosystem falls into disequilibrium that something new can emerge, that something new can be born. And here we are in the midst of a nation reaping what we have sowed for centuries. Our systems are breaking down, and we have fallen into disequilibrium. So what will we do? Will we only watch in horror and shock and disbelief? Will we only look outward? Will we try to solve our nation's ills by the same consciousness that has caused our sickness? Or will we look within? Will we consider how we have contributed to our disease? Will we grieve over what has been lost? Will we pursue healing for ourselves that has the power to lead us toward wholeness and holiness? Will we open ourselves to a vision that transcends the partisan divides we've given ourselves over to? Will we imagine together what could be, and through God's grace and power, what actually can be? Will we not just wait in eager anticipation, but will we participate in and give ourselves over to hardship for the sake of what is being born in our time, in our midst? Maybe this is the hope we need. Not to get us out of the mess and the suffering and the morass of division and hate, but a hope that is so strong and so resilient that we would move directly into it, believing that out of the rubble of our republic, life and peace and goodness can and will rise up. Will we be those who surrender to hope? Will we, as Cynthia Bourgeau writes, allow hope to make use of us rather than us making use of it? Hope tells us that even in moments like this, maybe especially in moments like this, there are endless possibilities. May we hear and trust and believe the words of the divine spoken by the prophet Isaiah in the midst of Israel's destruction, when God spoke to the people and said, "See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland." My friends, this is no paradisal dream. Hope tells us, hope insists, hope calls us to believe its hardship is its possibility. May this be so.